Chapter 21. Bernald rose and held out his hand. Oh, I see it was Howland who made you feel as if Pellerin were in the room? And he made Miss Fosdick feel so too? Why, of course. But why are you rushing off? Because I must hunt up my friend, who's not used to such late hours. Your friend? Mrs. Bain had to collect her thoughts. Oh, Mr. Winterman, you mean? But he's gone already. Gone? Bernald exclaimed, with an odd twinge of foreboding. Remembering Pellerin's signal across the crowd, he reproached himself for not having answered it more promptly. Yet it was certainly strange that his friend should have left the house without him. Are you quite sure? He asked, with a startled glance at the clock. Oh, perfectly. He went half an hour ago. But you needn't hurry home on his account, for Alice Fosdick carried him off with her. I saw them leave together. Carried him off? She took him home with her, you mean? Yes. You know what strange hours she keeps. She told me she was going to give him a Welsh rabbit and explain Pellerinism to him. Oh, if she's going to explain, Bernald murmured. But his amazement at the news struggled with a confused impatience to reach his rooms in time to be there for his friend's arrival. There could be no stranger spectacle beneath the stars than that of John Pellerin carried off by Miss Fosdick, and listening, in the small hours, to her elucidation of his doctrines. But Bernald knew enough of his sex to be aware that such an experiment may present a less humorous side to its subject than to an impartial observer. Even the Uplift Club and its connotations might benefit by the attraction of the unknown, and it was conceivable that to a traveler from Mesopotamia Miss Fosdick might present elements of interest which as he had lost for the frequenters of Fifth Avenue. There was, at any rate, no denying that the affair had become unexpectedly complex, and that its farther development promised to be rich in comedy. In the charmed contemplation of these possibilities, Bernald sat over his fire, listening for Pellerin's ring. He had arranged his modest quarters with the reverent care of a celebrant awaiting the descent of his deity. He guessed Pellerin to be unconscious of visual detail, but sensitive to the happy blending of sensuous impressions. To the intimate spell of lamplight on books, and of a deep chair placed where one could watch the fire. The chair was there, and Bernald, facing it across the hearth, already saw it filled by Pellerin's lounging figure. The autumn dawn came late, and even now they had before them the promise of some untroubled hours. Bernald, sitting there alone in the warm stillness of his room, and in the profounder hush of his expectancy, was conscious of gathering up all his sensibilities and perceptions into one exquisitely adjusted instrument of notation. Until now he had tasted Pellerin's society only in unpremeditated snatches, and had always left him with a sense, on his own part, of waste and shortcoming. Now, in the lull of this dedicated hour, he felt that he should miss nothing, and forget nothing, of the initiation that awaited him. And catching sight of Pellerin's pipe, he rose and laid it carefully on a table by the armchair. No. I've never had any news of him, Bernald heard himself repeating. He spoke in a low tone, and with the automatic utterance that alone made it possible to say the words. They were addressed to Miss Fosdick, into whose neighborhood chance had thrown him at a dinner, a year or so later than their encounter at the Uplift Club. Hitherto he had successfully, and intentionally, avoided Miss Fosdick, not from any animosity toward that unconscious instrument of fate, but from an intense reluctance to pronounce the words which he knew he should have to speak if they met. Now, as it turned out, his chief surprise was that she should wait so long to make him speak them. All through the dinner as he had swept him along on a rapid current of talk which showed no tendency to linger or turn back upon the past. At first he ascribed her reserve to a sense of delicacy with which he reproached himself for not having previously credited her. Then he saw that as he had been carried so far beyond the point at which they had last faced each other, that it was by the merest hazard of associated ideas that she was now finally borne back to it. for it appeared that the very next evening, at Mrs. Beecher Bain's, a Hindu Mahatma was to lecture to a Uplift Club on the limits of the subliminal, and it was owing to no less a person than Howland Wade that this exceptional privilege had been obtained. Of course, Howland's known all over the world as the interpreter of Pellerinism, and Tyaga Gauch, who had absolutely declined to speak anywhere in public, wrote to Isabella that he could not refuse anything that Mr. Wade asked. Did you know that Howland's lecture, What Pellerinism Means, apostrophe has been translated into 22 languages, and gone into a fifth edition in Icelandic? Why, that reminds me, Miss Fosdick broke off of Never Heard, What Became of Your Queer Friend, What Was His Name? Whom you and Bob Wade accused me of spiriting away after that very lecture. And I've never seen you since you rushed into the house the next morning, and dragged me out of bed, to know what I'd done with him. With a sharp effort, Bernal gathered himself together to have it out. Well, what did you do with him? He retorted. She laughed her appreciation of his humor. Jay, just what I told you, of course. I said goodbye to him on Isabella's doorstep. Bernald looked at her. It's really true, then, that he didn't go home with you? She bantered back, have you suspected me, all this time, of hiding his remains in the cellar? And with a droop of her fine lids she added, I wish he had come home with me, for he was rather interesting, and there were things I think I could have explained to him. Bernald helped himself to a nectarine, and Miss Fosdick continued on the note of amused curiosity, so you've really never had any news of him since that night? No, I've never had any news of him. Not the least little message? Not the least little message. Or a rumor, or report of any kind. Or a rumor, or report of any kind. Miss Fosdick's interest seemed to be revived by the strangeness of the case. It's rather creepy, isn't it? What could have happened? You don't suppose he could have been waylaid and murdered? She asked with brightening eyes. Bernald shook his head serenely. No. I'm sure he's safe, quite safe. But if you're sure, you must know something. No. I know nothing, he repeated. She scanned him incredulously. But what's your theory, for you must have a theory? What in the world can have become of him? Bernald returned her look and hesitated. Do you happen to remember the last thing he said to you, the very last, on the doorstep, when he left you? The last thing? She poised her fork above the peach on her plate. I don't think he said anything. Yes, when I reminded him that he'd solemnly promised to come back with me and have a little talk, he said he couldn't because he was going home. Well, then, I suppose, said Bernald, he went home. She glanced at him, as if suspecting a trap. Dear me, how flat. I always inclined to a mysterious murder. But of course you know more of him than you say. She began to cut her peach, but paused above a lifted bit to ask, with a renewal of animation in her expressive eyes, by the way, had you heard that Howland Wade has been gradually getting farther and farther away from Pellerinism? It seems he's begun to feel that there's a positivist element in it which is narrowing to anyone who has gone at all deeply into the wisdom of the East. He was intensely interesting about it the other day, and of course I do see what he feels. It's too long to tell you now, but if you could manage to come into tea some afternoon soon any day but Wednesday, I should so like to explain. The eyes, we had been put in the mood for ghosts that evening, after an excellent dinner at our old friend Culwin's, by a tale of Fred Murchard's The Narrative of a Strange Personal Visitation. Seen through the haze of our cigars, and by the drowsy gleam of a coal fire, Culwin's library, with its oak walls and dark old bindings, made a good setting for such evocations, and ghostly experiences at first hand being, after Murchard's brilliant opening, the only kind acceptable to us, we proceeded to take stock of our group, and tax each member for a contribution. There were 8 of us, and 7 contrived, in a manner more or less adequate, to fulfill the condition imposed. It surprised us all to find that we could muster such a show of supernatural impressions, for none of us, excepting Richard himself and young Phil Frenham, whose story was the slightest of the lot, had the habit of sending our souls into the invisible. So that, on the whole, we had every reason to be proud of our 7 zibbets, and none of us would have dreamed of expecting an 8th from our host. Our old friend, Mr. Andrew Cohen, who had sat back in his armchair, listening and blinking through the smoke circles with the cheerful tolerance of a wise old idol, was not the kind of man likely to be favored with such contacts, though he had imagination enough to enjoy, without envying, the superior privileges of his guests. By age and by education he belonged to the stout positivist tradition, and his habit of thought had been formed in the days of the epic struggle between physics and metaphysics. But he had been, then and always, essentially a spectator, a humorous detached observer of the immense muddled variety show of life, slipping out of his seat now, and then for a brief dip into the convivialities at the back of the house, but never, as far as one knew, showing the least desire to jump on the stage and do a earn. Among his contemporaries there lingered a vague tradition of his having, at a remote period, and in a romantic clime, been wounded in a duel, but this legend no more tallied with what we younger men knew of his character than my mother's assertion that he had once been a charming little man with nice eyes corresponded to any possible reconstitution of his dry thwarted physiognomy. He never can have looked like anything but a bundle of sticks, Murchard had once said of him. Or a phosphorescent log, rather, someone else amended, and we recognized the happiness of this description of his small squat trunk, with the red blink of the eyes in a face like mottled bark. He had always been possessed of a leisure which he had nursed and protected, instead of squandering it in vain activities. His carefully guarded hours had been devoted to the cultivation of a fine intelligence, and a few judiciously chosen habits, and none of the disturbances common to human experience seemed to have crossed his sky. Nevertheless, his dispassionate survey of the universe had not raised his opinion of that costly experiment, and his study of the human race seemed to have resulted in the conclusion that all men were superfluous, and women necessary, only because someone had to do the cooking. On the importance of this point his convictions were absolute, and gastronomy was the only science which he revered as dogma. It must be owned that his little dinners were a strong argument in favor of this view, besides being a reason, though not the main one, for the fidelity of his friends. Mentally he exercised a hospitality less seductive, but no less stimulating. His mind was like a forum, or some open meeting place for the exchange of ideas. Somewhat cold and draughty, but light, spacious and orderly, a kind of academic grove from which all the leaves had fallen. In this privileged area a dozen of us were wont to stretch our muscles and expand our lungs, and, as if to prolong as much as possible the tradition of what we felt to be a vanishing institution, one or two neophytes were now and then added to our band. Young Phil Frenham was the last, and the most interesting, of these recruits, and a good example of Murchard's somewhat morbid assertion that our old friend liked 'em juicy. It was indeed a fact that Cohen, for all his mental dryness, specially tasted the lyric qualities in youth. As he was far too good an Epicurean to nip the flowers of soul which he gathered for his garden, his friendship was not a disintegrating influence. On the contrary, it forced the young idea to robuster bloom. And in Phil Frenham he had a fine subject for experimentation. The boy was really intelligent, and the soundness of his nature was like the pure paste under a delicate glaze. Cohen had fished him out of a thick fog of family dullness, and pulled him up to a peak in Darien, and the adventure hadn't hurt him a bit. Indeed, the skill with which Cohen had contrived to stimulate his curiosities without robbing them of their young bloom of awe seemed to me a sufficient answer to Murchard's ogreish metaphor. There was nothing hectic in Frenham's efflorescence, and his old friend had not laid even a fingertip on the sacred stupidities. One wanted no better proof of that than the fact that Frenham still reverenced them in Culwin. There's a side of him you fellows don't see. I believe that story about the duel, he declared, and it was of the very essence of this belief that it should impel him just as our little party was dispersing to turn back to our host with the absurd demand, colon, and now you've got to tell us about your ghost. The outer door had closed on Murchard and the others. Only Frenham and I remained, and the vigilant servant who presided over Culwin's destinies, having brought a fresh supply of soda water, had been laconically ordered to bed. Culwin's sociability was a night-blooming flower, and we knew that he expected the nucleus of his group to tighten around him after midnight. But Frenham's appeal seemed to disconcert him comically, and he rose from the chair in which he had just reseated himself after his farewells in the hall. My ghost? Do you suppose I'm fool enough to go to the expense of keeping one of my own, when there are so many charming ones in my friend's closets? Take another cigar, he said, revolving toward me with a laugh. Frenham laughed too, pulling up his slender height before the chimney piece as he turned to face his short bristling friend. Oh, he said, you'd never be content to share if you met one new Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.